Good morning. Welcome to Senate Finance. Today is Thursday, April 27, 2017. The time is 9:06 a.m. If you're joining us off-net or online, we're in Juneau, Alaska, the fifth floor of the State Capitol Room 532. I'm Co-Chairman Anna McKinnon. With me this morning, Vice Chairman Bishop.
Good morning, Madam Chair.
Senator Von Imhoff.
Good morning, Madam Chair.
Senator Hughes.
Good morning, Madam Chair. It's good to be back.
Senator Olson.
Good morning, Madam Chair.
Majority Leader Michicki.
Good morning, Madam Chair.
Senator Hoffman is excused today. He's away on a family emergency. Before the committee today is HB 111. Is there anything to come before the committee before we begin? Seeing and hearing none, I'd like to invite online we have Rich Ruggiero and Roger Marks. We'll be first hearing from Rich Ruggiero. I would like to acknowledge that Senator Giesel and Senator Stedman are with us this morning, as well as I'm looking in the audience to see if we have any representatives here this morning. Welcome, Senator Stedman, Senator Giesel. Mr. Ruggiero, if you could identify yourself for the record, and then please begin with your discussion. Brief
at ease. Good morning, everyone. This is Rich Ruggiero with Castle Gap Advisors. And today I was kind of asked to look at three aspects of the committee substitute that's before you, and that has to do with the topic of the deductibility of NOLs, then look at the concept of uplift, and then talk about general Alaska competitiveness based on this committee substitute. So if we could have the slide turn and go to slide number four. And the slide that's up there is titled How Are Explore Producer Costs Recovered. I'm going to go through this quite quickly, so I'll just leave it open for questions because almost all the topics that are covered in here have been covered before, and I know a number of you are quite familiar, so if I go too fast, you can just slow me down with some questions. But otherwise, we're going to talk about net operating losses, and that's basically created when in any given year the cost that a producer incurs exceeds the amount of revenue that's available for recovery of those costs in the year. There was a lot of questions as this topic came up in other committees about, well, how is this handled in gross-based systems? Well, gross-based systems don't worry about cost. They don't worry about recovery of cost because it's based off of the revenue. And generally, the only costs that are allowed to be handled or deducted are just those between the ultimate market, wherever that is for the product, and then getting that value transmitted back to the lease unit or well boundary. But net-based systems are pretty prevalent around the globe. Even a lot of countries that have royalty, which are gross-based systems, have a net tax involved as well. So having a net-based system is not unusual. But in those net-based systems around the globe, there are dozens of different methods for the producers and explorers to be able to recover the costs that they've expended in their attempt to find and produce hydrocarbons. And they range both in the quantity that can be recovered at any point in time. They range also in the amount of time that it takes. And then there's other incentives that some countries put around the recovery of those costs. If we can move on to slide number five. What's the value of recovery? I'm going to just show an example in a second in a subsequent slide. But I can take the same project and run it against fiscal systems in many different regimes. And the internal rate of return to the producer and the net present value on a discounted basis of that producer will vary greatly. And this whole dialogue of looking only at marginal rate to somehow decide whether a system is competitive or not, The reason why there are hundreds of billions invested in countries that have higher tax rates than Alaska is because they have systems in place that generally allow the producer to recover their costs quickly and in such a manner that it reduces the risk of investing. And I bring up IRR and NPV because in every, you know, when I worked as a producer, those were the two key metrics that we used when we were kind of comparing projects to decide what to invest in. And I know in the last year and a half and working with multiple producers and multiple funding entities and putting the two together, IRR and NPV came up in every one of our discussions. So they are two key metrics that need to be looked at as you move forward. And you might ask, how do you get such variations then in the economics if you got the exact same field with the exact same production and cost profile? A lot of this comes down to a number of things, not only in time, but it comes down to which costs are actually eligible to be recovered. Different regimes have either looser or tighter requirements on what can be listed as a recoverable cost. We've talked about the interest of the uplift. Are there one or more tax rates? Because then you need to look at the rate at which you are allowed to recover those costs versus the tax rate that's applied to the profit. And then is the recovery of those costs that are against the petroleum tax, is that the only time you get a deductible, or are they also deductible when it comes time to pay your corporate income tax? So really the combination of all the above when you get into cost recovery really go to inform the producers as to how attractive a regime is and also their willingness to invest. Slide 6, retaining value for NOLs. What you've had in the past is a structure that is a very generous structure that allowed 100% recovery of those costs and the value of those through a concept of the cashable credit. So after I spent and they were allowed expenses, I could then apply for, get my certificates, and get the cash. Removal of this option creates a challenge then on how the producer can still get full value. And the reason I'm going to talk about full value, and as you switch to carry forward of losses, is that when we started to look at and to model the Alaska system in both sort of a legacy moving forward and then in a new project basis, what we found is that the interaction through the use of deducting carry forward NOLs with per barrel credits and hard floors that they existed actually showed that the producer would not get the full value of the deduction and the recovery of his costs because of that interaction. And it was just a term that we put together in a presentation that's posted as part of this bill on March 29th. It was the concept of a wasted NOL. And a wasted NOL is a dollar deduction that actually has no tax benefit to the producer. Slide 7. This is, you're probably all very familiar with this, but I just wanted to go back down through the structure because it'll help as we talk about some things later on. But if we start with the gross value at the point of production, it's there that you subtract your current cost, and then if you have any carry forward NOLs, you subtract them up there, plus any appropriate GVR reduction. After subtracting all this from the GVPP, you essentially end up with your PTV or production tax value. We've got rules that say you can't go below zero. And from that production tax value, you then calculate a preliminary tax using your statutory rate right now of 35%. And then you subtract any barrel credits that you have, and this results in your net tax. And then if your operation is subject to a hard floor, you calculate the gross minimum tax, you compare the gross and the net, and ultimately you pay the higher up. And I know there's variations on this for Middle Earth and Cook Inlet, so most of this conversation is really around North Slope, and as you actually put in the bill, a lot of this on carry forward NOLs, and the rest is only for north of 68. If we go to slide 8, I just wanted to highlight how we start getting into this concept of using useful or wasted NOLs. And the issue comes up in that one of the first things you have to do under the statute is subtract your carry-forward NOLs. And you do so along with current costs until you get down to a PTB of zero. And then once you have a PTB of zero, that gives you a zero net tax. If you have a hard floor, you're going to have to pay the minimum anyway, even though you've taken your net tax all the way down to zero, which in a way then says you've wasted the use of those costs and NOLs in that you've taken something down to zero, but you're going to be ultimately liable for paying a minimum gross tax. So before I start down my examples, any questions?
There are no questions at this time, Mr. Ruggiero.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. I'll go on to slide 9. So I put together a simple single barrel example, and I made the numbers very simple for just showing the impact as we go through this. So what you can see is we've taken and I've got a non-GVR column and a GVR column so we can follow all the way through. So we've taken the barrel, we got market, we subtract the transportation, you get the gross value, then as applicable, you subtract your GVR, then your cost, then your NOLs, you get a tax value, calculate tax, apply your credits, get your net tax, and then you can go through a minimum if it's there, and then you get the tax paid. If you look at our non-GVR column, you'll see that the net tax is controlling, and on this one barrel in a $75 market, it would be $4.25 net tax, which is greater than the $2.6 of minimum tax. On the GVR side, what you would see is, again, the net tax payable at the application of the appropriate barrel credit is $2.70, and that's what's controlling. So that's without the use of any carry-forward NOLs. So now let's go to slide 9, and let's assume this individual has $50 of available carry-forward NOLs to use.
Mr. Ruggiero, that's slide 10. Mr. Ruggiero, slide 10, just so that we have those following at home.
Yes, I'm sorry, slide 10.
Thank you.
Which is the simple barrel example, but we've added in the carry-forward NOLs. So we just assume we've got $50 in available carry-forward NOLs. So if you follow down the non-GVR column, you'll see that absent any rule change, we would have to take off I'd have to use 35 of my 50 NOL to take the PTB to zero. Obviously, with the PTB at zero, I've wasted down my sliding scale barrel credits because there's nothing to use them against, and I'm going to end up paying the $2.60 net tax. On the GVR side, I use the 22, which takes me, again, PTB down to zero, which means I really didn't need my per barrel credits there either against that. But I do use part of those per barrel credits because I can use that to pierce the gross minimum floor if it should exist, and that would take me down to a zero tax. So in this case, following the rules as they would be, I either have to use 35 or 22 of my available cash carry-forward NOLs. If we go on to slide 11, we're talking about the optimized use of the NOL, and this is what the committee substitute bill is achieving. If I only use the amount of NOLs necessary to have my net tax equate to whatever gross tax I owe, then I'm efficiently using and getting value for those NOLs. So you'll see in this example that if I only use a roughly $4.72 worth of NOL, I get a PTV of, on the non-GVR column, I get a PTV of $30.28, a tax of $10.60. When I subtract the $8 of barrel credits that I have, it says my net tax would calculate to $2.60, which is the same as my gross tax. So in essence, I only needed to use $4.7 of NOLs to get me down to the same point where my net tax and my gross tax were equal. So if without this legislation that allows me only to optimize the use of my carryforward NOLs, I would have wasted $30 out of the $35 that I was applying in the previous slide, or basically 86% of my NOLs would have been wasted. If I go down the GBR column, I only need to use $1.77 to get my net tax to come out if I actually had a gross floor that applied, to equate that out so that way I find out that my NOLs would be wasted in that example as well. So the whole idea here of these examples is not the absolute numbers, but it was just, and I used a $75 market because I could get both the non-GVR and the GVR to show that under the current system, if I just switch from cash flow credits to carry forward NOLs, that the value of those NOLs would not be realized by the producer. And as I've stated and been quoted having stated many times, that if the producers aren't allowed to recover their costs and get the associated tax benefit of recovering those costs, that would move Alaska quite low, if not to the bottom of the worldwide competitive scale for this aspect of a project.
Sure.
So on to slide 12.
Mr. Ruggiero, could we stay on slide 11 for a moment? Senator Olson.
Actually, Madam Chair, I'd like to go back to slide 10, Mr. Ruggiero, where your PTV is down to zero and you're dealing with the carry-forward NOLs. Do you have to use all your NOLs to bring the PTV down to zero? This is my question.
Senator Olson, through the chair, my understanding and reading of the current legislation that you have is the producers are obligated to take whatever available costs they have as well as any carry forward costs and use those to take and apply them until they take the production tax value down to zero. And then only what is still remaining becomes a carry forward loss to the next year.
So the, Madam Chair.
Senator Olson.
So the answer to the question is you do not have to use all your NOLs in order to bring it down to zero.
Olson, through the chair, my understanding was that if you have this as you're doing your calculations, you would have to apply them to get down to zero. But what the current bill would allow them to do is to choose how much of those NOLs they use, so therefore they only take it down to the point where their net tax and gross tax would equalize out.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Olson. Are there further questions? Mr. Ruggiero, please continue. Slide 12.
Slide 12, takeaways. You know, really something we found is that you've got the interaction between many mechanisms in your tax code, because not only do you have the GVR, non-GVR, you've got the carry forward NOLs now, you've got sliding barrel credits, you've got GVR credits, and you have taxpayers that when they do segment returns within a segment, they can actually have both a combination of GVR and non-GVR. So if you've got a lot of interlocked, interdependent mechanisms that you just have to keep in mind that as you change one thing, there may be impacts on others, and you have to kind of look at the package as a whole. And really, as we've gone through and done our modeling, this interaction between the various mechanisms does make it fairly difficult for a producer, especially on a new project, to make their carry forward losses and or their recovery of their costs, is a better way of saying it, to be used and useful can take over 20 years in order for that to happen, especially at the type of prices that we're talking about now. And then the final bullet point on there is the language that's been put forth in the current committee substitute will allow the producers to make that election on how to use their NOL so that they become most used and useful for them. So that ends the sort of the basic discussion on why there are some issues associated with carry forward NOLs and why the language in this committee substitute to allow the producer to choose how and when they use those NOLs. The next section is on uplift. If we go to slide 14, and I mentioned this sort of in my opening, that time really has, and I've seen in all the projects that I've worked, that time has more impact than sometimes tax rate does. And how things happen and when they happen impact producers from the sense that the more time it takes to get something to happen, the more things can go wrong, and the greater the risk that the producers take on in those projects. So what we did is I just took a simple hypothetical, and this was presented in a couple other presentations of the committees, but we ran some models, and it's got the exact same amount of money being spent as cost. It's got the same amount of cash flow coming back in from the sale of hydrocarbons, and it's got the same profit split between the government and the producer. And in the top three cases, which I'll show the results on the next page, the cash flow is identical to each, only the timing changes. On the fourth one, there's a slight shift in the cash flow because we go to a non-useful recovery of the NOLs. So if we can now go to slide 15. The four different timing scenarios. So again, we're dealing with the same pool of dollars. The spending time is the same and the cash flow. And the only thing that is different in all of this is when the producer gets their money back. And you can see that if we talk about immediate recovery, i.e. they get it right after investing. So this can be someone like your cash flow credits were, or a producer that's doing a segment return and they have enough income, positive income coming from other operations that they can immediately deduct it. And you can see with immediate recovery, the internal rate of return or IRR is 27%, the net present value is 46%. And the producer cash flow is 120. If I go to an accelerated recovery, it's still not immediate, but it comes as fast as the revenue in the project will allow it to be recovered. The IRR drops from 27 down to 20. The net present value takes about a 40% hit, even though the cash flow and the amount of money in both of those is identical to the producer. Then if we go to delayed recovery, which is very akin to what anyone in any business would see as a asset depreciation schedule for capital that they've spent, this can be something like a straight line over 4 years, 5 years, 10 years, whatever the appropriate law is. And if you do that, you can see from the immediate recovery, which are case number one, the economic results I get is my rate of returns cut in half, my net present value drops by two-thirds, even though I'm getting the same amount of money. This is just pushing the dollars around between now or later as we go through it. And then if we run it to where only 50% of the NOLs are useful, so we've been talking about useful recovery and non-useful recovery, so if only 50% is useful where they get a tax benefit from it, you can see that drops the IRR down to 6. The net present value is negative. And that's a project which I can tell you after running the scoping economics, I wouldn't be spending much time on it any longer trying to make it work because that would be too far off the type of numbers I would need for approval. So again, I put this up there just to show how important timing is and taking the same dollars that have no uplift and no interest, but if I just move them out several years, that when you go through the discounting that takes place in calculating net present values and internal rates of return, it has a significant effect on the producer economics, and it's those economics that will be used for an Alaska project to be compared by each company against other projects that they have in their portfolio that could be funded. So if we go to slide 16, the reason regimes offer uplift is to offer some form of compensation for the timing differences. If it takes a little bit longer to get to things, then the uplift, or this, another word for uplift is just interest on the carry forward, allows for some improvement in the producer economics. What I have down here is, based on all the regimes I've worked in, is you could fill the room with experts, and you could fill it with days of testimony on what is the right or fair share of uplift that A, producer should receive, and B, what a government or sovereign should offer up. I break it down pretty simply, is that I look at the long-run return of companies in the upstream sector. And if you look at those that have existed for 20 or 30 years, you'll see everything from plus or minus around 12% to 20% plus. I mean, some of the ones that have done very well are pretty high. And technically, to be kept whole on the timing related to NOL recovery and cost recovery, that they would need to receive that type of interest rate, because that is their opportunity cost for their capital. If they had it, they could be putting it to work in projects that generated that type of return. Governments around the world tend to look at the world as to where they generally invest their money, and you get into bonds and different mixes of low-risk equities and the rest, and you'll see that, much like probably the Alaska Permanent Fund, is you get long-run returns between the 4 to 6%. And thus, that's where you get into in deciding what sort of uplift to give, is you're trying to balance, I'm going to say, a lot of the upstream companies that would love and have internal expectations in the 12-plus range, and you've got governments in the 4 to 6. So settling somewhere between means both sides give a little. The state would be giving a little bit to allow something greater than what its long return is on its money, and the producers would be taking a little less than what their opportunity cost is going forward. So the recommended 10% uplift in the community substitute kind of fits right into that space between government return and producer return. Go to slide 17. I could spend a lot of time. This was just a simple table for everybody to just kind of look at the varying impacts of interest as you go forward. And what we've done in the table is down the left-hand side, you've got numbers 1 through 20. That number, that represents years. Across the top of the table, we have starting at 4%, and we go up in 2% increments all the way up to 20. And the boxes that are shaded in yellow under each of the interest rate columns just tells you the year when roughly at that interest rate you would double your money. So at the 10% interest rate, if you never used any of the NOLs or never touched whatever you started with, in 7 years that would double in absolute terms. In time value terms, like I said, the producers might think it's a little less than what they should have at that point in time. The state may think it's a little more than they should give at that point in time. But I just put that up to just show how long it takes something to double, so that will give you an idea of how numbers will grow when you start talking about roughly 7-year time frames and 10% uplift rates. Slide 18. But once you get an idea and try and get comfortable with what the right uplift rate is, then you have to think about for how long do you offer it. And I know in all the places I've personally worked, there are so many aspects of and these other interrelated parts of the fiscal regime and also the type of projects that are being impacted that suggest what the right length of time is for providing uplift. If you're in a regime, let's take Permian Basin, or you're talking the Bakken in North Dakota, where I can buy a lease, get a rig, and be drilling in 30 days and have production in less than 90 days, that would suggest one form of uplift and one set of timing. When you're talking about offshore projects or remote jungle projects, and even these Arctic projects where you might have 5 to 7 to 10 years lead time, where in each of those years you're incurring not insignificant costs for bringing your project forward, it might suggest a little bit longer time to do that. My second bullet point goes to, in a way, uplift is a self-correcting mechanism to the extent you don't have to worry about giving away too much. If XYZ happens, you know, for example, if you're concerned, well, geez, what if their production goes way up and the project's a lot more economic? Or what if the price of oil goes up and, again, it's a lot more economic? Well, when you're talking about uplift is the more profitable something becomes, the more quickly they use the NOLs and the less uplift that is ever applied and recovered. But if the circumstances just turn the other way around, where it's prolonged either due to lack of reservoir or lack of price, then the uplift is there as a way to try and, again, keep that producer as whole as possible with recovery of their cost. In this type of situation where you've got segment or aggregated returns for petroleum tax, obviously legacy producers that have sizable current production will be advantaged. And new players, kind of depending on the price forecast, you know, are going to be looking at project economics where it takes a long time from when they start working on a project before they're ever going to be able to fully recover their costs. Okay, next I was going to just go into some modeling runs. So any questions up to here?
Other questions from committee members? Please continue.
Okay, slide 19, modeling runs. We've been using the same life cycle model, which is really it's a $10 billion, 1 billion barrel North Slope project that hits a peak production of 120,000 barrels a day in there. We've added in, based on requests, to kind of combine the life cycle with legacy. So what I've done is I've taken your current production on the North Slope and just applied a 6% decline. Now you can debate whether it should have been 3, should it be 10, or whatever, but I use 6, which is about the middle range of what's been talked about on the North Slope. So I used the start of 500,000 barrels a day, and I use very rounded numbers, so I've been using $10 for transportation shipping and $30 for the overall cost per barrel on the legacy. And so we went ahead and took a look at things, and you'll see on the following charts, combining new with legacy, and we'll combine new where it's GVR and non-GVR, and we'll do it with and without a hard floor. These are runs that we were asked to do and we had put together. And just some observations is obviously, you know, we talked about on non-GVR, if a hard floor is applicable, it really controls at prices all the way up to almost $80. And going then as the last bullet point says, with no hard floor, the absent actually on the hard floor, taking it away, doesn't show much improvement to the new project aspect on the combined economics that we're doing. That there's actually other things that have more importance to the overall economics on a new project coming in. go to slide 20? So slide 20 is legacy production, and we've put, when it says legacy operator, we've said that legacy operator is a single operator that runs all 500,000 barrels a day. We're just doing the combination. And we have a new oil field, which is by $10 billion, 1 billion barrel. And we've run the model such that we don't have any wasted NOLs, and there's no hard floor. The additional assumptions that we were given that we ran, as you can see at the bottom, is we had 7 years of spending prior to first oil. That would be, you know, a combination of everything of exploration, appraisal, permitting, and actually construction before we got to first oil. And we were asked, so regardless of price, to put a 3-year limit on the use of the GBR benefits. So that's the GBR reduction and the 5-barrel as opposed to the sliding scale barrel. What each of these plots you'll see, they show the same thing as we go through all of these. So since we have a no hard floor, the very first line in the table going across under the price, basically, since there's no hard floor, there's no years at the minimum tax, but that will come into play where you do have the hard floor. The max NOL, that says, what is the largest value of the carry forward NOLs in the circumstances? You can see at $40 barrel, at $40 per barrel, I've got almost $10 billion in NOLs that I will be carrying forward somewhere in that project. But if I go to $100 oil, I have zero carry forward. What that says is every dollar of spending on the new project can be immediately deducted from the very positive revenues coming out of the legacy of production that's associated with it. So again, you can see as I go through different price runs, and for the audience, the prices that we used are what we call flat nominal prices. So when it says 40, it was 40 for every year of the project. If it's 55, 55 every year, et cetera. It's a simplified way to compare runs to runs. But given the NOL, you can see the max NOL, the third line down then tells you which year you actually start to recover the NOL. So when do you need NOL to reduce your tax burden and where it's effective and useful. And you can see we have 7 years of pre-production investment, so production starts in year 8. And under the $40 case, you'll see that, I don't even know why it says starts 8, because we never recover the NOLs, and we never really need them at $40 because I got $40 costs coming in. And we move forward. But as you go up to the $55 barrel, you'll see NOL recovery doesn't start to year 14. And it's not fully recovered to year 21. So that's 8 years to recover the $4.9 billion in NOLs in a used and useful format. As I go up to $70 a barrel, you'll see I start a little sooner because I got more income, so I start in year 11. And I'm done with in just 4 years, years 11, 12, and 13. If I go to $85 a barrel, I recovered first year, whatever I carried forward, which was a very small amount, then at $100 a barrel, I have no NOLs, it's taken care of. So you can then also come down the next five lines, three of them are for the producer. What you have is the internal rate of return, the net present value at a 10% discounting, and then the producer cash flow. This is their total cash, no time dependency whatsoever, whereas the discounted NPV 10 is time dependent as you move forward. So we compare that to the state cash flow, and then we ran the state net present value at 6% discounting. Just wanted to point out some things which you'll see as we flip through these next cases. At the $40, you'll see the state's roughly 60% at $10 billion total cash flow, and the producer about 40% at $6 billion. That's the impact of your royalty and gross minimum tax kicking in where it does. Now, this has no hard floor, so it doesn't have the gross minimum, but your royalty is included in these total flows for the state. So this is where your regressive tax, any gross tax, which is regressive, starts to show itself. When we pop to 55, you'll see positions reverse. Producer cash flow is $20 billion. State cash is only $17. In a lot of the work that that's been previously presented on what the net effective tax curve looks like in Alaska, with the combination of the sliding barrel credits or the GVR reduction and the $5, is somewhere around $55 a barrel is where all these curves bottom out at 6, 7, 8% net effective tax. So what that's showing you at 55 is exactly that impact of having extremely low net tax where producer take is actually greater than what the state take is. When we get to 70 is when things start to even out between the state and the producer, and then as the price grows and the per barrel credit start to disappear with each $10 increase, you lose another dollar, you'll see that the state share starts to increase. So again, we just put this together so that way, and I went through this one in a bit of time, because what I want you to look at are things like the max and oil line, when's the last recovery year, so how long does it take to get money back, and then sort of what the relative position is between the state and the producer on the cash flow basis.
Mr. Ruggiero, we do have questions. Senator Machicki.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Ruggiero, I'm assuming these numbers are production tax severance only and do not include the economics of royalty as well. Is that correct?
Senator Machicki to the chair. No, the state cash flow does include royalty.
Thank you.
Please continue.
Okay. If we go to slide 21, this is just the previous slide now with a hard floor, and you'll see that at the low oil price, the addition of the 4% hard floor plus royalty, whereas in the previous one we were at about a 60-40 split, state 60, producer 40, we're now down here to about a 75-25 split between the state and the producer, and that's the impact at the lower prices of the hard floor being applied. Again, at 55, the hard floor has been an impact, but the producer still has a little better cash flow than the state does at 19.5 to 18.5. But then as we get to higher prices where the hard floor no longer comes into play, you'll see very similar numbers as between the producer and the state as you run that out. Now, with the hard floor there, you're not going to use as many NOLs as you go forward. So what I want to take you up to is on the column under the 55. If you remember from the prior slide, at $55 a barrel, it started in year 14 and went through year 21, or 8 years. Now at $55 a barrel, you start using your NOLs in year 15, and you don't recover them all until year 37. And that's because plus or minus around $55 a barrel, the hard floor does come into play quite often. And so to make those NOLs used and useful, you can see if someone was putting together a new project and were existing in the $55 world, even if they're a legacy producer, it could take them a couple decades before they are able to get all of their costs back. Now, again, as you work your way up to the higher prices where the hard floor doesn't come into play at the current cost structure, then that goes away and the numbers start to look a whole lot like they did on the chart without a hard floor. If we now go to slide 22. And on slide 22 for the new field that goes along with the, as we go forward, this is now just without legacy. So this is a new operator, has no legacy production, and has a field that will qualify for the GVR reduction, but we actually limited it to just a strict 3 years in all cases as we went forward. Again, I'm not going to run through in detail, but if you just kind of compare, you can see the max NOLs, even at the higher prices, whereas the legacy operator had no NOLs at $100, a new player is still going to have almost $7 billion in NOLs at its peak as he's carrying forward into his years of production. You look at the fourth line down, which is the last year in which they recover their NOLs, and you can go across and you can see that even with $100 oil, it takes them to year 14 before they've recovered all their costs. And then you can see, because it's a single project, you can see the IRR of the project. Obviously, at $40, they're not going to do a 5% IRR project. And then you can see that the cash flow is going through again. The reason for showing these charts, I just want to emphasize that as you start to look at how long you allow an uplift, is a little bit of thinking through the situation of what price forecast are you thinking they're going to be in, and then how long it really takes them even at those price forecasts. You can see here, for a new operator without any existing production and no legacy income to use to deduct and recover those costs and those carry forward NOLs, it's many years out into the future before they're actually able to recover them.
Please continue. Okay.
Mm-hmm. And then on to slide 23, it's actually the same as the previous chart, which had no hard floor. This one puts in a hard floor. And you can see at the lower prices, that has quite a bit of an impact. At the higher prices, less so, but still some minor impact as it goes forward. But again, you still see that even in a robust price scenario, it's 15 to 20 years into a project life before they fully recovered their NOLs.
Mr. Ruggiero, we have a question. Senator Von Imhoff.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Ruggiero, I really appreciate the comparison of the no hard floor with the hard floor that you've done with legacy as well as now new oil. So what it seems is that there is a trade-off between receiving, with the state receiving more money in the short term with a hard floor, but then prolonging the NOL's final recovery year. Is that correct?
Senator Von Imhoff, to the chair. That's the correct interpretation of the data.
Senator Von Imhoff.
Thank you. The follow-up question then is, with a potential per-barrel credit, whether it be on the sliding scale, but I guess with GVR, it's just a flat five. So since we're looking at the GVR slides right now, the new oil, this is assuming a $5 credit, though, or $5 per-barrel credit that does not pierce the floor. Could you talk about that, please?
Senator Von Imhoff, to the chair. First of all, based on just sort of the guidelines we were given, is we only ran the $5 for the first 3 years. And that is allowed to go through the floor. However, starting in year four of production, this then flips over to the sliding per barrel credit that is not allowed to pierce the floor. And so what you're seeing is that some of these lower prices, the hard floor doesn't kick in for the first 3 years, but we're running a 40-year project life, so it kicks in for years 4 through 40. And you're seeing the impact of that then in the cash flows and the IRRs.
Senator Von Imhoff.
Thank you, Mr. Ruggiero. I do see that you have in parentheses, does not reflect current statute.
I have with the chair. Yes, that was a request that was made of us to take a look at that to see just really what the impact would be if there's only 3 years.
Thank you very much. That's all. Thank you. Please continue.
And I guess I want to follow up and say this is no way a recommendation that that's what you ought to limit GBR to. That's just a request that we were made. And I think what the slides do is you just go back and forth and compare the slides, legacy with and without, new player with and without. It's more to see the impact of the NOL recovery, which is what we're really looking at today, is how long it takes or how short a time it takes, depending on the current position that you're in as a producer.
Thank you, Mr. Ruggiero. Please continue.
If we go to then slide 24, we've gone ahead and still running a new operator with GBR-eligible new oil, and we're running a calculation so there's no wasted NOLs, put in a hard floor and added a 10% uplift. If, you know, sort of at the $40 and $55 price levels, again, your cost structure is so high, you've got the hard floor and the rest, the fact that you have uplift doesn't improve things that much, you would say, in the economics and all. But as you get out to the $70 and $85 columns, you'll notice that you get only slight improvements in the IRR and the NPV10s, even though what you see are a growth in the max NOL that the producer reaches, and that's a result of the uplift on their costs until the point in time at which they can start to recover them. And that's the uplift that occurs during the development period on up to the start year of recovery, which we have is somewhere around 10 to 14 in the uplift case. Again, just sort of in summary, the project type, the new project type that we looked at, if you're really targeting the North Slope and your goal is to bring a number of these new projects on, then I think the uplift timing and the rules associated with such really need to take into account the type of projects that you've got coming forward and adapt around those so that way it makes it used and useful for the producer and it achieves the goal of getting new oil into the pipeline. And again, if you look at low prices and you look at where you're at today and say I'm giving something that could grow to be massive and mammoth, because look at that maximum NOL line. It gets as high as $12 billion. When on the other cases, it was down around $6 billion. But that only occurs if the price is low and the state's getting their gross minimum tax and the rest in this. If the price goes high, then everybody wins. It's a profitable project. They're able to recover their costs with some uplift, and the pipeline continues and the legacy fields that you have today continue to flow. So that's the end of my comments on uplift. Any questions there before I finish up?
Senator Von Imhoff, do you have questions? No, there are no questions. Please continue.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So the last thing we're asked to look at is competitiveness under the current committee substitute. And looking at it for the legacy players, especially those that have significant production, I think this is a positive for them because the language that you've got defines the priority use of the various deductions. And for legacy players, this allows quick recovery of costs and NOLs. And it even allows, where possible, credits to be recovered from corporate income taxes. And I think that even opens up a bit of a market of more folks that might be interested in buying credits that are existing, as there are other people who can put them to work right away. For the new players, the uplift obviously helps, but as I've run through my model, and we even ran what I thought was a good case versus the 7-year man, you know, that we were asked to run as a pre-build. Even if I take that down to 5 years and move my project around a little in its parameters, it still takes much longer than 7 years before these producers get to recover their costs. And again, this is what I said, I would take a look at that just to make sure you're designing it for the type of project you see coming on. And I may have, my second bullet point on new players, I may have read too much, but I think the way I read it is if you got one barrel of production, you lose uplift. Now, you may have some small players that ultimately choose to be a developer of a larger project or take a share of a larger project and help it get done. And I just think one barrel of production that terminates their uplift, my suggestion is you look at some threshold. Could be 1,000 barrels. I've recommended 5,000 barrels a day before the uplift ceases to be payable. Because if someone's actually a 10% owner in a $10 billion project, they're putting up they're $1 billion plus in getting that done, and to get no uplift because they got a barrel of production and they've got no real income to offset it against would be detrimental to them. What I could not read in the language, and it just may be me, so I apologize if it is me, but I couldn't get the sense in reading the uplift on whether that applied to an annual package of uplift or uplift overall. And so each year you create a different amount of carry forward losses. So the 7-year clock and the uplift, does each annual package have its own calendar running as to when it starts and when it stops? And both for the use of it and then the timing of the uplift and all that comes with it. So again, that just might be helpful to have some clarity as to how that works, going forward. And my recommendations, which I have down there, is that whatever the 7-year window and uplift associated with it, however it applies to each annual amount separately. And that when NOLs are used, they're on a first-in, first-out basis. So that then will work its way towards allowing the recovery of those NOLs and the producer recovering their costs to be more used and useful to them. So, Madam Chair, that ends my slides and prepared remarks.
Thank you, Mr. Ruggiero. I do want to acknowledge that Senator Costello has joined us. Welcome to Senate Finance. Are there questions from committee members? Mr. Ruggiero, thank you for your presentation today. We'll look forward to continue working with you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Brief at ease. I'd like to call Senate Finance Committee back to order. It's Thursday, April 27, 2017. The next presentation on HB 111, Oil and Gas Production Tax Payments and Credits, is a presentation from Roger Marks. You have the presentation in your binder. Mr. Marks, are you available online? And if so, if you could identify yourself for the record, and then please proceed with your presentation.
Good morning, Madam Chair. This is Roger Marks. I'm under contract at LBNA. Am I coming through okay for you?
Welcome.
Okay, so I've been asked to offer my perspective as well on the current CS before you. Prepared a few brief comments. I listened in on Mr. Ruggiero's presentation, and many of my findings are basically consistent with what he found. If we go to slide two, it's sort of a summary here of my analysis. At a very high level, I found that the CS is successful at reducing the state's credit exposure without compromising the competitiveness of the overall fiscal system. The competitiveness does not significantly change relative to the current SB 21 system. What I'll offer is some economic observations regarding the interaction of how loss recovery, the per-barrel credit, and the gross minimum floor interact under the CS, again with an emphasis on how and whether loss recovery happens. And I'll also conclude with the two lingering issues or unresolved issues that the committee may want to consider weighing in on in your deliberations on the CS. If we go to slide three, sort of a preface here in terms of defining the landscape we're looking at. You know, the current production tax under SB 21 under the CS, it's a net tax with a 35% rate. And there's a 4 on that net tax equal to 4% of gross value. And one sort of theme that's going to play through my presentation here is that the per-barrel credit and loss recovery perform distinct functions. The per-barrel credit, whether it's the sliding scale credit for non-GVR oil or the $5 credit for GVR oil, these per-barrel credits provide tax relief to partially offset the high burden of royalties at low prices. This is something I discussed in my previous testimony. We could go Saturday on April 15th. So these per-barrel credits reflect sort of this year's business, what's happening with prices and costs this year. And since you can't carry forward these per-barrel credits, if you don't use them, they're lost forever. And the function they play within the statute in terms of partially offsetting the burden of royalty at low prices, if they're not used, that role is eviscerated. And loss recovery is sort of a prior year issue, where per-barrel credits reflect this year, loss recovery reflects what happened in previous year, and it provides for the deduction of costs and computing net value that could not be deducted in prior years. And unless these losses are accounted for and deducted, the income is overstated for the net tax calculation. And so since these two mechanisms, the per-barrel credits and loss recovery, they are a distinct issue, it's important to keep in mind that using both of them is not redundant. It's not a so-called double dip. And one should not look at these, since you've used so much of one, that means you should use less of another. And again, I'll be returning to that theme as we go on here. If we go to slide four, let's just remind ourselves of why we have the per barrel credit. And what I have here is a brief income statement depicting what I call the royalty problem, and this is just for using GVR oil or new oil. If we start out with an ANS price of $50, I believe ANS closed yesterday at about $51. But a $50 ANS and $10 transportation cost, the gross value is $40. And since this is GVR oil, it's more expensive. I used upstream costs of $35. So the 40 minus 35 is net value of $5. And the royalty, 1/8 of the gross, 1/8 of the $40, would be $5. So if you subtract the royalty from the net value, that gives you producer income before the production tax of zero. So, and that's a government take before production tax of 100%. So obviously this is not a commercially sustainable situation in terms of the investors being able to pay back their cost of capital. So the per barrel credit is necessary to throttle down the tax rate at low prices. It's an important feature. It doesn't, obviously, it doesn't pay back any of the royalty, but it keeps the production tax situation from making the royalty situation worse. And again, the per barrel credit is the distinct issue from loss recovery. You know, the per barrel credit is sort of reflects this year's economics, and loss recovery reflects prior year's economics. So if we go to slide five, just a basic summary of how the credits, the per barrel credits and loss recovery and the floor interact under current statute and under the CS.
Mr. Marks, we had questions on slide four.
Yes, Madam Chair.
Senator Michicki.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Marks, the Mr. Ruggiero is using $30 for upstream costs, and you're using $35. Can you just talk a little bit about that, please?
Well, looking, I believe Mr. Ruggiero was using $30 for non-GVR oil. I couldn't tell from his presentation what number he was using for the GVR. The numbers I was using for upstream, again, going back to my presentation on April 15th, per the revenue source books that breaks out the non-GVR oil, it looks like it's about $25 a barrel upstream costs. For the GVR oil, there's a wide spectrum of how much more expensive that could be. I added $10 to the non-GVR oil to get here a upstream cost of $35.
Senator Michicki.
Thank you. I just think it's an important note to clarify. Thank you very much, Madam Chair.
Mr. Marks, please continue.
So going on to slide five, again, a summary of how these mechanisms interact under current law and under the CS here. So for losses, for both currently, the way losses are treated for both non-GVR and GVR oil, you can use losses to bring your tax below the minimum floor. And the way losses are monetized under current law is if you take 35% of your loss and get a loss carry forward credit, under the CS, you actually carry the loss itself forward and it will become an additional lease expenditure which you'll deduct. Under the CS, whereas under the current system, you can use losses to go below the floor. Under the CS, for both non-GVR and GVR oil, you cannot use losses to bring your tax below the floor. For the per barrel credit, whether again it's a sliding scale credit for non-GVR oil or the $5 credit for GVR oil, currently, for the non-GVR oil, you cannot use the sliding scale credit to bring your tax below the floor. For GVR oil, you can go below the floor with a $5 credit, and the CS keeps that in place. No change there. So if we go on to slide six, I'm just going to make some observations about what hardening the floor does in terms of being able to recover losses. Again, under the current law, there's a loss carry-forward credit of 35% of your losses. You can carry that credit forward to bring taxes below the gross. Under the CS, you carry forward the loss itself, and it's an additional deduction in addition to your lease expenditures in the tax year. But you can only, under the CS, you can only use losses to bring your tax down to the gross floor. So if we go to slide seven, let's talk about what the impact would be on the non-GVR oil there. So as long as you're paying on gross, where sort of 4% of gross is greater than 35% of net minus your per barrel credits, and you're paying on gross, and if you can't bring your taxes below gross using your loss credits or using your losses, you know, the changeover point is about $65 a barrel. That's where you go from using the gross floor to the net tax. And so there would be no loss recovery unless prices get above about $65. And again, that's assuming a $25 upstream cost. So what does that say about the ability to recover costs? Well, with $25 in upstream costs, losses aren't generated, you know, until prices get down to about $35 a barrel. And if the situation, if you look at the next bullet, if you have a situation where you have, you know, legacy producer with GVR oil producing other GVR oil, I say there the losses, when that second bullet where I say losses on development of other non-GVR oil, the word should be costs rather than losses. I apologize for that. But in a situation where you have the legacy producer producing non-GVR oil, developing another non-GVR oil, most likely you would have offsetting income where you could recover the costs in the year they were incurred, unless prices were very low. And by recover them, I mean you could reduce your production tax value using the losses to the point, you know, until they were higher than the gross minimum. And that way your costs for developing another non-GVR oil would be recovered. So insofar as for non-GVR oil, unless prices get very low, you wouldn't be really, it appears like you would not be generating significant losses. And so loss recovery on the GVR oil does not could be a significant problem. But if you do generate losses with the hard floor, unless prices got above $65 a barrel, you would not recover your losses. So on slide 8.
Mr. Marks, can you pause for a moment? Senator Von Imhoff, did you have a question?
No, it's not formulated enough in my mind.
Okay, thank you.
Sorry.
Please continue.
Okay, on slide 8. So let's talk about what would happen with instituting the hard floor on a GVR oil. And what a producer would do, since you lose, you know, lose your, if you don't use your per barrel credits, you can't carry those forwards. Where losses you can. Producer would generally use their per barrel credits first before they use their losses. So, and in general, what a producer with GVR oil would do is use their per barrel credits to bring their tax down to zero. And this example here, an ANS price of $50 and transportation cost of $10 gives you a gross of $40. The gross minimum tax would be $160. And you could use your per barrel credit to bring your tax down to zero, which is what you would do. And, you know, as I showed on April 15th, similar to this, for the GVR oil, taxes would be, you know, just using that $5 per barrel credit, taxes would be zero through the price of about $75 a barrel, until that point when royalty starts taking less of a bite out of the basic economics. If you go to slide 9, so in focusing on GVR oil here, what does that say about loss recovery? Well, most new development on the slope would be GVR oil. And companies with substantial existing production income could offset their GVR costs. Again, on that first bullet where it says offset GVR losses, I apologize, it should say could offset their GVR costs. Losses are only expenditures from prior years. But with either situation where a legacy producer is developing new GVR oil, a situation like ConocoPhillips, you know, might develop the Willow field, you could offset the cost for develop for the new field with your existing production and recover those costs in the years they're incurred by reducing your production tax value to the point where they're higher than the gross minimum. Now there are some exceptions to this. Again, specific taxpayer data is confidential, but it seems likely if we think about what was going on when a few years ago when Point Thompson was being developed, where it was kind of sort of a perfect storm. It was a $4 billion field at the same time when prices cratered at about $30 a barrel. In that situation, you could have a situation where your existing production would not offset your cost of developing. But what about TVR production from companies without existing production? Well, again, since we said before, since the per barrel cost cannot be carried forward, producers would use those per barrel credits first. And with the hard floor, as we said before, you'd be only be able to recover your costs at that point where your net tax calculation exceeds your gross minimum tax calculation. For the GVR oil, that would occur at about $85 a barrel. Now, under HB 247 that was passed last year, there was provision in there that said GVR status sort of goes away depending on the price of oil. If prices are above $70 for 3 years, you go from GVR to non-GVR. After 3 years, if prices don't get above $70 for 3 years, after seven years, you automatically revert from GVR to non-GVR. And when that happens, you can no longer use your per barrel credit to take your tax below the minimum. And at that point, taxpayers may start recovering. So, but even in that scenario, given the high costs of the GVR oil, and when things would flip from the gross calculation to the net calculation, at prices below $80, you would not really be recovering your costs with the hard floor. So going on to slide 10, my second observation on uplift. Uplift is a widely used provision around the world for cost recovery. The way uplift would work in the CS is for the first 7 years after you start developing a field, any unrecovered losses are inflated at 10% compounded, and that happens for 7 years. And it only applies to companies without existing production. So what uplift does is provide a net present value boost to companies who have to wait to have production offsetting income. And again, under the CS, it only applies to companies without production. Just one comment here. If you think of a company who has only limited production for offsetting income, and just one company that comes to mind, for instance, is Kalis. If they were to develop Smith Bay, the only offsetting income they would have, given their current production, is from Ugaruk and the other field they're developing. Forgot the name. That's a satellite of that. I think those would total about 30,000 barrels a day. That would just make a very small dent in offsetting the cost of developing Smith Bay. So companies with only limited production may not be in too much of a different situation than companies with no production in terms of the issue cost recovery makes in terms of not being able to have offsetting income. So maybe something the committee may want to think about in if they want to go ahead and pursue the uplift provision. Again, so even if you do get the uplift here, the same situation we talked about before applies. After 3 years or 7 years, you revert to GVR status. And I believe that's probably why you get 7 years of uplift that meshes with the 7 years of when you flip from non-GVR to, or from GVR to non-GVR. And so again, even with the uplift, if you have it, you don't start recovering costs till prices get high. And there's a certain irony here too. What uplift does is increase your lease expenditures. Your losses get escalated by the 10% compounded. So you have higher lease expenditures when you do get in a situation where you can deduct your losses. And what that does is give you a lower production tax value and sort of increase, and what that does is increase the price at which you have the crossover between the gross and the net. So the irony here is the uplift decreases the probability of having prices high enough where you get to start recovering your costs. So slide 11. Numbers talk about what I mentioned before, a couple of unresolved or lingering issues in the CS you may want to think about addressing. The first issue is the ordering of deducting losses versus the per barrel credit. And under the way the CS is structured now, there are two possibilities. You could use your losses first or your per barrel credit second, or use your per barrel credits first and your losses second. You still get the same answer, but there's a big nuanced difference in sort of the overall outcome here. And just look at this string of numbers here. What this shows is non-GVR oil assuming a $5 loss carry forward. And under column A here, you have an ANS price of $55, $10 transportation costs, so a gross value of $45, which gives you a gross minimum at 4% of $1.80. And you have upstream costs of $25. And in this example here, you want to use, you have $5 in losses, and you want to use your $5 in losses to take your PTV down to $15. And your tax at 35% rate, your tax on the $15 will be $5.25. And even though you have $8 in per barrel credits you use, you can bring those below the four, so you use $3.45 in per barrel credits to take you down to that $1.80, which is the gross minimum. Or you can do under column B. Now in this one, we use the losses first. In column B, we're going to use the per barrel credits first. It starts out the same. ANS price to $55, transportation costs of $10, gross value of $45, upstream costs of $25. But here you're going to not use any of your losses. So your PTV is $20, the $45 minus the $25. You subject that to a 35% tax rate. You get a $7 tax before the credit. And again, even though you have $8 in per barrel credits you can use, you use $5.20 of those to bring you down to the $1.80. Well, the same answer, right? The gross minimum was $1.80. You ended up with $1.80. What's the difference? Well, the big difference here is under column A, you use $33.45 here per barrel credits. And in column B, you use $5.20. And again, since you can't carry your unused per barrel credits forward, a producer would probably want to use the mechanism in column B here. So going on to slide 12, use of the order, which order you use to deduct losses from the per barrel credits. Recognizing the per barrel credits lapse if they're not used and unused losses can be carried forward. The CS does not specify which is used first. And given the hard four for the non-GVR oil, the hard four on the losses, it will probably be the taxpayer's benefit to use the per barrel credits first and get down the floor and carrying their unused losses forward. This would be consistent with utilizing the functional intent of the per barrel credits and loss recovery inherent in the statute. So going to slide 13, just questions the committee may want to consider thinking about. You know, should the statute specify the sequence? Should, you know, do 100% of available losses have to be used first, or do 100% of available per barrel credits have to be used first? Can the taxpayer mix them up? And basic question, should the statute specify the sequence? Should the statute leave it up to the taxpayer? Should the statute leave it up to the department to determine the ordering here? And again, something the committee may want to think about weighing in on. If we go to slide 14, the second lingering or unresolved issue is the question of what does it mean to use a credit to bring taxes below the floor? Now, under the CF for GVR oil, losses cannot bring taxes below the floor, but the per barrel credit can. And let's just suppose we have this example here. We have a tax before credits of $10. The minimum tax is $7. The per barrel credits are $5, and the losses are $4. Losses you're carrying forward are $4. So if we go to slide 15, under SB 21, under the current law, there was a similar situation to this for non-GVR oil. Under the current law, you can use loss carry forward credits to bring tax below the floor, but for the non-GVR oil, you cannot use the sliding scale credit to go before the per barrel. You cannot use the sliding scale per barrel credit to go below the floor. So what DOR, Department of Revenue, issued a reg in 2013. It's 15 AAC 35G, and this reg was reinforced in an advisory bulletin they put out just last month. What this reg and advisory bulletin did, it basically gave the taxpayers two options how to deal with this situation. On the left, you have a situation where your tax before credits was $10. You could use $3 in losses to bring the tax down to the $7 minimum, but you couldn't use any per barrel credits to reduce the tax further. And so your tax, you took $10 in tax before credits, less the $3 in losses gave you a tax of $7. Or you could do it the way it is on the right here. You start out with tax before credits of $10, and you could use $5 in per barrel credits, but not use any of the losses to reduce your tax further. So you can start out with $10 and $10 before credit, $5 per barrel credit, and you end up with tax of $5. One way you end up with a tax of $7, one way with $5. And the underlying perspective on how the department came up with these rules is the perspective that if you use both credits, they are both the cause of getting below the minimum. In other words, if one of those brings you down to the floor and the other brings you beneath, it wasn't just the second mechanism that brought you before the floor, below the floor, it was both of them. I'll talk about that sort of an example in a sort of an analogy in a minute here, but just, we go to slide 16. There's an alternative way you could look at this situation, which you could not do per the DOR regulations and advisory bulletin. It's a alternative way you could use both credits. And rather than saying that they are both the cause of getting below the minimum, the perspective is only the credit or only the loss that actually brings you below the floor is the cause of getting below the minimum. So in this alternative, with that perspective, you start out with $10 in tax before credits, use $3 in losses to bring your tax down to $7. Then you can use the per barrel credit to go below the floor for GVR oil. You could use $5 in per barrel credits to bring your tax down to $2. So as before, under DOR, you could do something that gave you a $7 tax or a $5 tax. Using this perspective, you could get down to a $2 tax. So if we go to slide 17. So when the statute says something cannot bring the tax below the minimum, it's ambiguous as to what that means. And here's just an analogy. This is what's going on in these two different examples here. Suppose you have $100 in your checking account and you write two $100 checks. Well, did both checks or just the second check cause you to be overdrawn? Per the DOR perspective, it would say both checks cause you to be overdrawn. With the alternative that we showed in the prior slide, it would say just the second check caused you to be overdrawn. Now, I guess neither one of those perspectives is unreasonable, but personally, I would say, at the risk of extending the metaphor, the bank would only assess an overdraft fee on the second check. So if we go to slide 18, what's at stake here? Again, if we recognize the distinct function of each credit and what the statute is trying to accomplish, the per barrel credit is not loss recovery, and loss recovery is not the per barrel credit. And again, as we said, starting off, using both of them is not redundant or not a double dip. Now, in section 10 of the CS addressed a similar situation with the use of credits but not losses in the situation where credits can bring the tax below the floor. And what section 10 of your current CS says, the taxpayer can use the credits in any order, and you can use multiple credits to go below the floor. So, basically the perspective that's reflected in section 10 of the CS is the one we saw on slide 16, that really only the actual credit that actually brings you below the floor is the cause of getting below the minimum. So, again, this is something the committee may want to consider addressing for losses, because losses aren't addressed in Section 10 of the CS. You can leave it, the committee can leave it to the statutes, or leave it to the taxpayer, leave it to the department, or leave it open-ended, but it may be something you want to think about. And that, Madam Chair, concludes my presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Marks. Are there questions from committee members? Senator Von Imhoff.
Thank you, Mr. Marks. It seems to me that we should address and be very clear on how and when the NOL can be used, so there is no misinterpretation between the Department of Revenue and the producers of the carry-forward NOL each year. As if only partially is used, then there's an outstanding balance that we're carrying forward. And if there's a disagreement on how much is being used versus the per barrel credit, which of the $100 checks you were using in your analogy, there could be a disagreement in the interpretation of how much NOL is being carried forward. So I can see your point here. We had better tighten that up and make sure it's clear.
Through the chair, Senator Imhoff, I always be a big fan of the less ambiguity in the statute, the better. And then you all, it's up to the legislature to determine how these laws work. And so I think it would be, something the committee should strongly consider weighing in on in their proceedings.
Other questions from committee members? Seeing and hearing none, thank you, Mr. Marks, for joining us. We look forward to continuing to work with you as we have the CS from Senate Resources on House Bill 111 before us. Is there anything else to come before the committee? Seeing and hearing none, I would like to announce that tomorrow morning at 9 a.m. we're going to move away from HB 111 for the morning meeting and talk about the Senate's fiscal plan. The Senate's fiscal plan is being argued about in the other body and spoken about by the administration in ways that may be confusing to Alaskans. And so as a part of the process, we will set aside some time for the Senate Finance Committee to help maybe answer questions and provide clarity to what SB 26 that we sent over to the House actually does and doesn't do in regards to a comprehensive fiscal package that leaves an income tax unnecessary for Alaskans. At 1:30, we will recess until 1:30 and then have invited testimony on HB 111. With that, we're adjourned. Thank you.